Before I finish up on today's lecture, I've got a pile of handouts that I want to distribute. You think I brought Dieter here just so you could get a preview of what the summer's class is. Turns out that's not really the case. What happened is I had so much stuff here that I needed somebody to help me carry it all over. So I made Dieter sort of an offer he couldn't refuse, and we got it all carried over. But I made myself promise I'm not going to carry it back if I can possibly avoid it. So what I have here is, this is another one of the co-generations. I probably won't get to that today, but certainly next week. This is part two. I did a Piazza message for that. So how many people have yet needed a part two? Let me distribute those. The remainder are 3 and 4, which you almost certainly don't have. So I'll just start them around for everyone. And these are all of it. So once you're through all this, you'll have complete cogeneration for CSX. Our plan will then be to finish up number one. Oh, cool. Finish up number one today. And do the remaining ones next week. And that'll give you a chance to pour through them and get some questions together. So what I've shown you so far is how to use variables, but I haven't shown you much yet about declaring them, and that's kind of backwards since the declarations have to come first. But I wanted to sort of get into the meat of how the actual executable instructions work before we worry about setting them up through the declarations. So what we'll first do is global declarations. Those are at the field level, and that means that these will be processed. Remember how it works is that you have a particular case where you have a class and you have all the fields and then all the methods so that the various methods have access to the fields. Each field has to do a declaration. In Jasmine, you essentially use the name of the particular field, but there's one slight gotcha that took me a while to figure out, and that is that there's a sort of hidden rule that thou shalt not have field names that are equal to the operation codes in the language. That means if you decided you want to have, for some crazy reason, a field named IADD, it would mess up. It would confuse the field versus the actual operation. So a standard trick around that, and many languages have sort of variations on this, is that we essentially go ahead and append a dollar sign to each particular field name the user creates, thereby creating a valid identifier name, a valid field name, I should say, but one that can't possibly clash with an operation code, which don't include dollar signs. And you see there's a lot of cases, if you're anybody's a C++ hacker or something, there's oftentimes the case that certain names have a underscore at the very beginning or at the end, or even sometimes a double underscore, to show they're internally generated names that are based on a user's name, but don't want to clash with it. And so it's sort of an old trick. So let me warn you in advance about that. So if you see us generating fields and you say, what the heck is that dollar sign for? It's just for this very off chance that we trip across a field name that happens to be equal to an opcode. Most of the opcodes are pretty oddball, but there's always a chance, so we might as well do it right. So what's going to happen is we have an oddity here, and it's the case that unlike most code, which gets generated once, declarations actually have to be translated twice in some cases, in two different contexts. And it's because declarations mix initialization, which is actually code, with a declaration. That is, I can say something like int I equals 1. That's not so bad, because it turns out that field declarations allow for trivial initialization of a known literal value. But the language is actually even more complex than that. I can say int j equals 2i plus 1. And unless I'm willing to go ahead and track the particular literal value, sort of a version of folding, I said, here's a case where I may have to do a computation to actually get the initializer. But the trouble is initialization code goes in methods. In Java, the only place you can have actual executable code is inside of a method, but a field declaration is not inside of a method. So the way we're going to handle this oddball case is actually translate field declaration that's sufficiently complex twice. First time to create the field declaration outside of a method, and the second time to add in initialization code inside of a method prior to the execution of the main method to essentially finish up all the initializations. So it says something that's not oftentimes done, but in this case has to be done to do things right. So to help set that up, we start asking, is it the case that we have an initializer that's pretty trivial? If it is, we'll simply go ahead and not generate code to compute the initializer because it's so trivial, but we'll simply include it in the field declaration. Otherwise, we will have to generate code and do the computation and then do the assignment as if it were done at the very top of a method. In fact, it'd be the very top of main. So before I do anything else, I have these couple of fields which need to finish their initialization. I'll do that, and then I'll go on to the user's code. So in this case, the first thing we say is this a trivial sort of literal? And I do a trick by essentially saying, let's look at the initializer and do a couple of cases of particularly simple ones. So if you remember, there's a way of asking a node whose type I don't fully understand if it's a particular kind of class. If you have too many of these, this gets pretty tedious. But in this particular case, I can say, are you an instance of? That is, of all the kinds of classes you may be, are you this guy? You have to say yes or no. Are you that guy or something else? So this is sort of like a computer science version of 20 questions. Are you animal, vegetable, or mineral or something? You know, so in this case, I check. I'll consider you pretty trivial if you're an integer literal node, a character literal, true or false, which of course represented as 1 and 0. And then I'll say, if you are an instance of one of these, I'll actually fetch out the value, that your integer value, the character value, a 1 or a 0. That's simply setting up the case where I'll do initialization of fields if they're particularly simple. So in this case, how do I actually declare a global field? Well, in this particular case, I'll simply say, are you, if you're a numerical literal that I can handle, I'll go ahead and do this following declaration. Now, this is kind of weird, so let's make sure we get all this properly done. It'll say this is the case where the initial value is a numerical literal, and I'm able to actually go and fetch it. So what I'll do is I'll generate dot field. That's a fixed thing that I always generate. Public is a fixed field I always generate. He's going to be a public field. He's going to be static. His name is a parameter. That's passed in. That's the thing that the user declared with the dollar sign appended, as we'll see shortly. The I is the capital I that stands for integer type. The equal is assignment. And the num value is the numeric value that I happen to got from the initializer if it's sufficiently simple. Yeah. It's static because I want them to act like global variables. I don't want them to have instance variables. In this case, I'm treating these all as if they're static methods and static fields. And remember, static methods cannot get at instance fields. That's right, but the situation, we're not creating instance of this class. We're only treating it as if it were a single static class. So if I had to do both, it'd be more complex. But in this case, the simpler of the two is make it all static, and that makes them global because all the methods will be able to see them, but they'll always see the same field. So these are the fearsome global variables that your programming instructors may have told you never to touch, at least until you're 21, and then only, you know, you have to talk to an advisor and get absolution. So we forgive you in advance. If it turns out that we have a particularly nasty initializer like this one, this guy will say, no, I do not consider this initializer numeric literal, and I'll create a simpler declaration. It says, I'm a field, I'm public, I'm static, my name is whatever, type is integer, but I won't have an initializer. But of course, there is really a default initializer that's zero, because in Java, all fields are default initialized. So the default is zero, but then we'll actually compute the value we want prior to actually ever using it. Well, situation, we're going to need to be getting into arrays, so we can also declare types that are global arrays. In this case, since I'm declaring fields, I want to be able to handle them all. If I'm declaring an array, its situation, it's field, public, static name, and I have to have an array type code. And I'm sorry, I went right past that. The array type code essentially says the three types we're allowed to have are arrays of integers, arrays of chars, and arrays of bool. And the type code is a left bracket without a right bracket. They don't have to match. The left bracket says I'm an array, and the right bracket, we're not actually delimiting anything, so it's not needed. So this thing says bracket I means array of integers, bracket C means array of characters. And why in the world do they have Z there instead of B, as you might expect? Byte, yeah. So the situation, you kind of think, if you've ever been to Paris, you can think of this thing, this is Zibul. And so that's why they use Z, because it's Zibul. And I never quite got French down, but they never quite got English down, so we're kind of at a standoff. So we got those types. I mean, this is one of those things you inherit, and sometimes you need little mnemonics, and sometimes they're good mnemonics, and sometimes they're nasty mnemonics, but this is one I always had to keep straight. So at any rate, what happens here is that if I happen to have a global array, a field that's an array, in this particular case, I have to do a little bit of work behind the scenes, because in Java, we know, arrays aren't created unless you call anew. But how does this translate into machine code? Well, we're actually going to have to generate code that's equivalent to anew that says, give me a new array. Arrays are a little bit different than objects. Objects, you know, are part of the class hierarchy, but if you learned about arrays, they really don't quite fit in properly. They're treated kind of as an offshoot of arrays as a special modifier onto objects, which could be class objects or children of class objects. So the way they handle that now, this way, is actually, if I see I want to allocate an array, I actually have an instruction called new array. This will actually go ahead, and what I'll do is I'll push on the size I need and generate a new array, or a new array of characters, or a new array of booleans. But in this case, they decided to spell the darn thing out, so I don't need to say z boolean. I can spell it out as boolean, and they know what I'm talking about. So once I have arrays, or at least the possibility of doing arrays, I can store a reference to an array, and that's a put static, class name, and the type code, which is an array, or in this case, a local, which does an A store. It does an A store instead of an I store because I'm not storing an integer, I'm storing a reference. Now, why they don't call it R store, I don't know, but they call it A store, but it means it's a reference to an object, in this case, an array object. And with all that in place, yeah, come on, let's get that straight. I can actually now have a method that actually goes ahead and declares a field. And I have the special declare field method because I got to visit twice, once to do the declaration and once to do the initialization. So the declare field says, here I'm going to take the name of the field. There's that dollar sign business I warned you about that I'm adding in so that I'll never clash with an opcode. I'm going to declare, in this particular case, a global int, which represents its initializer, and set the fact that he's a label and he's a global. If I'm doing a constant declaration in this particular case, he's a global, and I get the constant initializer. If he's an array, I declare the array and set the array label, and he's a global. And finally, I have a visit routine, which will go to a varDecl node. And what's that going to do is, well, he's going to have to keep track. Remember, I warned you that he's going to have to do possibly two visits. So the first visit is going to be implemented by actually this declare field business I talked about earlier. So at this stage, it'll put a field declaration inside the class, but outside all the method declarations, because that's where it has to be as far as Java is concerned. Fields are outside of methods, not inside. If you're inside, then you become a local variable. So it says, is this the first pass? And somebody was asking me during the break, what's this none business about? Is that really worth anything? And I said, what's none for? It's good for initially recognizing the fact that you don't have something available yet. So we got plenty of nothing. In this case, I have none of nothing. So in this particular case, what I do is I initialize my address to none to indicate that I haven't set up the address yet. So in this case, if he says my array happens to be none, I call declare field. That'll do this business of generating the dot field with the proper field set in. Otherwise, I may be visiting him a second time. And I know it's the second time because one of the things these declare fields do is set up the type as global or local, but it clears out the none. So they not only persist until I have some information about addresses available. So in this case, he's a second pass. What am I going to do? Well, situation there. If he has a null initializer and he's not a literal, not an easy literal, I'll go ahead and compute his value and store him. That's exactly the same code I did in assignments a tad earlier. So what it's going to do is, if I have a sufficiently complex initializer like this guy, I've separated this into two pieces. I said I'm first going to translate int j. That'll be done on pass one. And then it's as if later on I had the code j equals 2i plus 1. And that's a plain old assignment. And we know how to do the assignment there. Essentially, we already have the address. So I compute the value and then do the store. And it's a store global, of course, because these are fields. Treat constants is essentially the same way that if I happen to have a constant field, notice that's perfectly legal to have a constant whose initializer is based on a variable. The constant's created, the value is set, and it's no longer changeable. And again, this is translated then as first set up the field n as if it were uninitialized, and then compute the j plus 10 and do a single assignment that sets the initial value and also, in this case, the final value for the const. And in the case of arrays, as I warned you, I have to do a tad more code. So in this particular case, I can also handle a case that I had something like this. I had integer array declared. Now remember what happens is we're doing a little bit different than Java does it. Java does it more as an object-oriented language. We do it a little bit more like a C-oriented language. In Java, you would have something like int A equals new, and what do we say there? Do I put just new 10, or no, what do I put in there? I forgot. Does anybody remember what I put in the new to create an array? Well, I guess I put an array, yeah, that sort of thing. So instead of doing it the Java way, we're doing it very much more the C way, which is perhaps the one that you're more familiar with. So in this particular case, what we're going to do is we're first going to determine, is he a global array or not? Sometimes I have to say, how do I figure that out? Well, remember, in this particular situation here, if the current method, that's the method we're currently in, is null, that means we're not in a method. The only way we can not be in a method is if we're in fields. So in this particular case, and I guess since it's the Beatles' room, they'd be strawberry fields, wouldn't they? Let's just hope it doesn't take forever to get it all done. In this particular case, we say, are you a global array? If your current method is not set, you are. Then in this particular case, I first set the address to none, just to set up this thing, do the first pass of declaring fields, and then return. If we're into the second pass here, we go ahead and we actually extract the size of the array. Remember, that was part of the declaration. So we extract that and push it onto the stack. We call an allocated array. So essentially on our stack, we have 10 if we want 10 elements. And we go ahead and call an allocated array that says, give me a new array of, say, type integer. Well, it says, how many elements? You look on the stack. It pops that value off and says, I want 10 elements. Make me an array of 10 elements. And what it does then, it pushes back onto this a reference to the new A sub 10. The effect, or I guess in sub 10, sorry. The new integer array of 10 elements. So in that particular case, it says, okay, that's now on the stack. If you were global, store it as a global reference. If you were local, that is, you did something like this inside of a method. We haven't gotten the method yet, but we're setting this up so it works in either case. Then we store a local reference. And okay, good, we got through that. And we go. Excuse me? Yeah. That's correct. That's right. We're going to go back and generate the additional code inside the body of a method, and it actually be inside the main. So we're inside the main. We say, well, we're ready to do user's code, but not quite, because we may have these uncompleted declarations. So I can go back sitting inside main. In this case, sitting in the sense that I've generated code that expects to be inside of a method. So I've created the dot method. I said, hey, I can generate code legally now. It's like waiting to be 18 or 21, I guess. All of you remember that one, the situation there. And you go back there and you say, well, I'm going to revisit these guys again in this new context, but it's going to recognize I'm in the second pass. And the second pass is don't do the declarations because that's already been done, but do the initialization. It's because this stupid thing is half declaration. This part is declaration, but that part is code. And we've either brilliantly or not so brilliantly mixed them together, but we as code generators have to pull them apart simply because of the rules of where things go. So that's what we do there, and that's what the second pass is about.
But according to your code, that would only happen if the current method
is no, that. That's right, that's right. And that's why, that's right, you're absolutely right. It's only if I'm in the context of fields and situation there. If I'm in the context of locals, I don't do this whole declaration stuff. So all this field stuff is only for global fields. For locals, I don't need to do the two passes. It's simply the case that the rule is for fields, the declarations about it can be outside the methods, but the initialization, because it's code, has to be inside. So I do the two passes. But you're right, if they were not globals, if they were locals inside of a method, I don't have that dichotomy. And the way I do a declaration is essentially say, I want one more local, please, and then start generating code and storing into that local. So it gets a little easier. After we do the assignment, I'm sort of thinking about the order of development of these things and what you could do to actually start generating some code and seeing if it's usable and workable. So now you can do some declarations of fields. That's cool. It's a situation here where you can do some expressions. And early on, certainly one of the things you're going to want to do is I/O, particularly the output part. But we'll do both input and output on the same area just to keep them together. So what we're going to do here, as I showed you earlier, is we have these various methods in CSX Live. Most of them have to do with I/O. If you look at CSX Live, there are a couple that do have to do with things like assignments. Remember these rules that say if I assign array parameters and to another array, I've got to check the length at runtime. The method will do this. It'll actually say, put the arrays on there. I'll check their length and throw an exception if they're bad. And if they're not an exception, I'll go ahead and do the assignment. There's also a rule that says I can initialize a character array with a string, and I have a special method that does that for me. So we have a couple of other things there. But essentially what we need to do is have a little routine that generates calls. These can be calls to our own methods, or they can be their library routines. All that varies is the exact path. Are we talking about java.this.this, or are we talking about our own class name .this.whatever? So in this particular case, I generate a call, and it does an invoke static with the method descriptor. And that's the actual name of the method I need to call, qualified with the class name and the full path, so it knows exactly where to find that. So given I have that, we can do reads. Turns out there are only two things we have to do about reads. So we're inside of a read node. Remember that multiple reads are handled as one at a time. So if I say read I, j, that's actually compile this first read I, generate that code, and then go back and read j, and they're two separate things. And again, that seems like, duh, so what? But actually there's a little subtlety involved there, because if I said read something like I, a sub I, You might ask yourself, well, which eye is it? Is it the before or after? You could, for example, argue that what he does is he grabs the address of A sub I, then does both reads, and having done both reads, I go ahead and get the old value of I as the address of A sub I. But one of the good things about knowing how something operates is that you can kind of ferret out what works and what doesn't work. And there's a lot of kind of folklore or misunderstanding about how things might work. If we know that reads are done one by one, there's absolutely no doubt about what this means. It means go ahead and do this read first. That, of course, implies an update of I. Then read this guy. And now it has to be the updated value of I, not the old value. So understanding how things are implemented and defining them in a simple way really does help clarify possible points of ambiguity. I'm sure there's still plenty there, but at least in this case, it helps make us understand what the language must do, and of course our implementation will do just that. So in this case, we're going to say a read is really an assignment, and I talked about that earlier. So when we did assignments, before we actually did the assignment, we set up the target variable by computing its address. So I said, go ahead and compute the address by the target variable. That's the guy being read into. So in this particular case, and then I'm going to say, well, what are you able to read? I know this is type correct, so the code generator can always rely on the fact that this is type correct. The type rule says you can only be this or that. Those are the only two cases I have to check. So we know the rule is I can only read integers or chars, so I'll go ahead and say, is your type integer? And in this particular case, if he's integer, I'll call the library routine readInt. Otherwise, notice I'm saying in comment that it's got to be equal to char. That's sort of a reminder that I've kind of used the law of the excluded middle. If it's not this, it's got to be that. I could check it if I wanted to. Maybe it's good coding style to check that and throw in a board if I got a third oddball value. I didn't do that for simplicity. That's a matter of your taste in coding. Do you use the fact that you know exactly what the rules are, or do you prepare yourself that the rules may be violated, perhaps if not now in future when the language gets extended? So this is not necessarily the best coding style, but it's a tad simpler, and in this case, it's not really going to get us into trouble, since I expect CSX is not going to have a long lifetime for you after the middle of next month. Just enough to play with a little bit and throw it away and say, on to the next challenge. So in this case, if we don't read an integer, we read a character. But notice what this means is we call a routine. It's going to go ahead and call standard input, get the input value, leave it on the stack, an integer or a char. I'm simply going to store that into the target variable and then recursively go and do any additional reads that happen to be on that read list that we had. So reads are actually pretty easy to implement. If we're processing arrays, remember we have to have this business about array type codes. So we got something that gives me these array type codes, an array of integer, array of chars, or an array of zabul. I now know how to load a global reference. I have a string, which is its name, and it's a type code. In this particular case, it might be an array type code, and I generate a get static of that particular type code. If I have a local reference, I go ahead and do an A load for the local reference, again, to an array object. And now what I'm able to do is update visit. It's probably a good place to stop. What I was going to say is, if you notice, I had a definition of name node earlier on. And what's happening is this one is an extension of that. So part of the code that I talked about earlier is unchanged. And you can just mark that as saying this is the same as the old stuff. What I've done is add a new case that I didn't include previously for simplicity. Now that we know something about arrays, I'm going to include it. And what happens is next week, we'll pick things up and we'll start talking about that extension. So you'll have plenty to keep you busy in the intervening week, and maybe I'll see some of you at office hours. Otherwise, have a good week, and we'll see you 7 days from now. For anybody who came in late, I have graded midterms if you need to pick it up. Yeah.